The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Dana Stevens, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest, Two Steves and a Metcalf edition. It's Wednesday, November 8th, 2017. On today's show, we will talk about Lady Bird, the solo directorial debut of the actress Greta Gerwig. It's about the relationship between a middle-aged nurse and her teenage daughter in the early 2000s, and it stars Saoirse Ronan and Laurie Metcalf. And then we will discuss Alias Grace, the new Netflix miniseries that's based on a Margaret Atwood historical fiction novel of the same name and is executive produced and written by Sarah Polley. This new miniseries was originally broadcast on Canadian TV. It's now found its way to our screens in the U.S., and we will discuss. And lastly, Rolling Stone, the venerable rock and roll magazine, turns 50 this year. There's a new biography of its founder, Jan Wenner, and there's also a new documentary on HBO about the legacy of the magazine. We'll discuss with Slate's senior writer, Seth Stevenson, and with June Thomas, the managing producer of Slate Podcasts and one of the co-hosts of the XX podcast. Hello, June.
Dana.
Seth.
Hello, Dana.
Dana, before we start, I couldn't help noticing that it wasn't the last time I was on the Culture Gabfest, but I was really struck as I got my voting information together this morning that this time last year, which is to say on election day, I came in and I subbed in for Julia, who was busy supervising Slate's election coverage. And that was the last innocent day,
That was the last day of our youth.
Yeah. The before times.
And this is the last day before the 1 year anniversary, right? Like, we're all going to get some sort of horrible PTSD attack at midnight tonight.
Something's going to happen.
I was covering the Trump election victory night party at the Midtown Hilton.
Wow.
One of the darkest hours of my life.
Oh, God. Surrounded by celebrants. That
surrounded
had to be
by people
really
in
hard.
Pinstripe suits and red Make America Great Again hats and a giant cake in the shape of Trump's head.
Oh. Wow. What we've been through since then. But you started right at the apex of agony. All right. Lady Bird is the title of the movie, and it's also the self-given nickname of Christina McPherson, played by Saoirse Ronan, who's an adventurous and outspoken teenager trying to define herself in Sacramento in the early 2000s. She's in constant conflict with her mother, who's played by Laurie Metcalf. This is Greta Gerwig's directorial debut. She's co-directed a movie before, but this is her first solo outing, and it's getting tons of critical praise. Last time I looked, it was at 100% on Rotten Tomatoes and a lot of early awards buzz for its script and its performances. Unfortunately, there are no clips available, but let's listen to a bit from the trailer from Lady Bird.
I hate California. I want to go to the East Coast.
I want to go where culture is, like
How
New
in the
York,
world did I raise such
or at least
snob.
Connecticut or New Hampshire, where writers live in the woods.
Get into those schools anyway.
Mom!
You should just go to City College. You know, with your work ethic, just go to City College and then to jail and then back to City College and then maybe you'd learn to pull yourself up and not expect everybody to do everything.
Lady Bird, is that your given name?
Yeah.
Why is it in quotes?
I gave it to myself. It's given to me by me.
Lady Bird always says that she lives on the wrong side of the tracks, but I always thought that that was like a metaphor. But there are actual train tracks.
What she did was very baller. Very
all right. Even though that's just a trailer clip, I think it gives some idea of the kind of sprightly dialogue and the mood of this movie. So I want to get reactions from both of you. Just quickly off the top, love, hate, would send people to or not. Seth?
Very sweet sensibility, very generous spirit, bops along, enjoyed. The performances are amazing. I will say, however, the media blitz had me ready for like a life-altering film. And I just thought it was a really good, really cute high school movie. The New York Times called it perfect. I would not go that far.
Yeah, it's interesting. Both the last sentence of the Times review by A.O. Scott and the last sentence of David Edelstein's review in New York Magazine used the word perfect and formulated the idea. I think Edelstein just says the ending is perfect and A.O. Scott says the whole movie. But yes, this movie has been, I agree, a little bit overpraised. I think it's a lovely, sweet coming-of-age movie. There's nothing about it I would really change, but it's kind of familiar territory, and I don't quite understand why it's being hailed like it's the 400 blows of 2017. June, what about you?
Well, I had not really seen any of the critical acclaim. I didn't read your review until after I'd seen it. And I don't typically care for the kind of Gerwigian-type movie. Like, I don't hate them or anything. It just doesn't really do it for me.
What's a Gerwigian-type movie?
Well, you know, like a Joe's, but like the kind of movie that she typically acts in.
Right.
The mumblecore.
Mumblecore.
A word that I have sworn never to put in writing in the pages of Slate magazine, by the way, and I stick by that pledge.
For which we thank you. Or even, you know, the movies that she's done with Noah Baumbach, like, they're not my favorite Noah Baumbach, but, you know, just, and I know that's unfair, and it's, like I said, not a hatred or anything, just not like, eh, it's not my thing. And I was super charmed, but I think the key in all of life is to go in with low expectations or not have overblown expectations. And
yeah.
I really liked it, and I was just, and the portrayal of the mother-daughter relationship particularly hit me because her mother is just like my mother.
Have been a difficult teenage kid.
So I was really, really like vibing on that.
Yeah, I think I agree. This was originally called Mothers and Daughters, apparently, the script. And it really does focus. I think the best scenes by far are the scenes between Laurie Metcalf and Saoirse Ronan. And there's lots of them. But there's a lot else going on, too. There's two romantic relationships that are pursued in her senior year of high school. There's a friendship betrayal and reconciliation. There's what else is going on there? Her father's depression.
Yeah. I mean, and financial concerns, which she is aware of, but like all teenagers of that age, oblivious to and trying to rise above.
I think that is a strong point of the movie, too, actually, is that it places itself it takes place in a particular economic and financial history as well as a cultural history. It's not, it doesn't alienate its concerns from the concerns of the wider world.
Yeah. And I think, as you pointed out in your movie, Dana.
In my review.
Sorry.
In my movie. That'd be great if I made little movies to go with each movie.
As you pointed out in your review, Dana, there are certain things. There are certain beats that are hit that are familiar high school movie beats, and yet nothing is overemphasized. There's no like thumb in your eye, finger on whatever it is, whatever anatomical analogy we're going to use. You know, there's no evil people. There's no horrible betrayals. There's no cads. There's like, it's a familiar movie that's about kind of nice people trying to rub along, trying to make it, trying to express themselves and grow up. And similarly, I thought the portrayal of like a squeezed middle family, they're not in the worst situation. The family's together in this actually super admirable way, really, you know, aspirational way. They just are really tight on money and they're having really, you know, very real financial problems. But they, you know, it's not overplayed. It's real and it's relatable, but it's not like, you know, they're not literally living in a cardboard box by the end or anything like that, that I actually think some movies might be tempted to fall into.
Yeah, that's true. You keep sort of, just because every movie has to have its catastrophe, you keep waiting for someone to die or become homeless or get pregnant or something like that. And I mean, sorry for the spoilers, but or the non-event spoilers, but none of those things happen. And so the smallness of scale is something to appreciate about it.
Dana, you mentioned it felt a little like familiar territory, and the movie it really reminded me of was Pretty in Pink, the Molly Ringwald movie written by John Hughes in the 80s. And
true, again, also class conscious.
It's a high school senior girl and who comes from a working class family, and she's got sort of a sad sack dad. She even has to sew a pink dress.
R.I.P. Harry Dean Stanton.
She even has to sew a pink dress just like Lady Bird does. And this movie felt like that movie in some ways, but it felt more from a female perspective, written from a female perspective, and B, it just felt a little more lived in and a lot more generous to its characters. So even the bad characters, like the bad boyfriend has a dad dying of cancer, or like the ditzy snobby girl is actually an AP calculus. You know, everyone has a backstory. Like the priest who directs the musical is also in depression and later meets with Laurie Metcalf to talk about his depression. So I love the way it took care to make sure every single character felt a little bit rounded, felt a little bit lived in. But the best part of it by far for me was really the performances of Laurie Metcalf. And then the other revelation for me was Beanie Feldstein, who plays Julie, the best friend, the best friend who gets kind of jilted for the snobby rich girl later in the movie. I just thought she just has such a delightful presence. I would like to watch a Beanie Feldstein, a Julie movie.
Would be my
pick as a spinoff.
Yeah. Isn't Beanie Feldstein a TV personality, June? Isn't she on some show?
She's Jonah Hill's sister.
In real life. Oh my!
Yes, no, in the movie. She's in real life. She's Jonah Hill's sister. She hasn't done a ton of stuff, but she's been. She was in Neighbors 2. She was one of the sorority sisters in Neighbors 2. But I just thought she was so fun in this.
Yeah, and again, she's someone who could have been so overplayed. And you almost, part of the enjoyment is knowing how that character would have been just tortured and mistreated in most other movies. She is
right because she's kind of a plain, overweight girl,
yeah,
right?
And she's fun.
But she's not seen as the outcast.
No,
of the school.
And she's sad. She suffers. It's not like she's oblivious to what's going on. She when things go wrong for her, she feels hurt, but. You know, life goes on.
I will say, and I don't want to spoil too much, so I won't get into it, but I thought her reconciliation after their break with Lady Bird was a little bit too easy and did something that the rest of the movie didn't do with that character, which was put her in the position of someone who needed her friend more than her friend needed her. I mean, couldn't she have one day of being annoyed that she had been blown off for so long?
Yeah, and I have to say that there's another, like, I don't, again, not to spoil, but the ending, which apparently was called perfect by some critics, I also felt a little too pat to me. There are some reconciliations that felt just a little bit unearned, but also they please you as a viewer.
What do we think of Greta Gerwig, the emerging auteur? I sort of saw this film as a prequel to Frances Ha, which she co-wrote with Noah Baumbach. And you could see this character of Lady Bird, later becoming Frances Ha, Frances Halloran, going to New York. And because in that movie, in Frances Ha goes back to Sacramento to spend some time with her family. And the parents are played by her actual parents. And she filmed in Sacramento. And this really felt like the prequel to that. This is like how Frances Ha got to where she was. So there's this emerging Gerwigian sensibility, June. What do we, how do we, she just got huge profiles in both New York Times Magazine and New York Magazine. A lot of buzz around Greta Gerwig. Are we excited for her future work?
Based on this movie, totally. I mean, there was just so much that's great about it. As you said, Seth, the roundedness of every character. I mean, this is a movie that I feel like I could, if I was in college right now, I would I could do my thesis on the driving in Lady Bird. Like, there's just, it's got depth. It's got real, it's got charm. The writing is great. The writing feels, when teenage girls speak, they sound like smart teenage girls or shallow teenage girls or whatever, but they sound like the kind of people they are. Priests sound like priests, hip priests or semi-open priests or whatever. And let's just take a moment to note Lois Smith, who was, as always, she's always magnificent, but she plays the kind of the head nun of the Catholic school that Lady Bird attends. And she doesn't have a ton of scenes. She doesn't overplay them, but she's so fantastic as just a really sensitive teacher who also, is kind of a disciplinarian, but not for the sake of it. And I just, there's so much to love in this film.
Yeah, I would say, in answer to Seth's question, I'm very excited about her as a writer. I think she has a little bit to learn as a director, but, she's early enough in her career that she can certainly get there. I think the naturalistic dialogue was a huge strength, but for example, I mean, this is something that comes between the director and the editor, but didn't you guys find the editing in this movie a little bit glib sometimes, a little bit punchy, like she'll cut right on a punchline and the scene will not quite last long enough? There were moments when I would have liked a scene or a relationship to develop a little bit more and not be, it moves very quickly through
it really
a set of comic
along.
Setups.
It never breathes. There's never any open space, really. And I think that was clearly a conscious choice. And I think that quick sensibility is kind of Baumbachian. I know in interviews she's talked about how people don't seem to respect her because they feel like Noah Baumbach is responsible for these things and they eliminate her role in those films. But it did feel somewhat Baumbachian in its rhythm and its pace and how quick it went.
For listeners who don't know, Greta Gerwig is now Noah Baumbach's living girlfriend, right?
We presume. I don't.
I think I read a profile that said they live together now, and he and they have co-written at least two movies together, Frances Ha and Mistress America, that she starred in. I like this better than either of those movies. I mean, we talked about Noah Baumbach on this show just recently because we did the Meyerowitz stories as a topic. To me, his strongest work is not when he's trying to, as you say, write from the point of view of a much younger woman. And that world of young people in New York that he shows in Frances Ha just didn't feel quite right to me. It felt like some kind of foreign gaze onto that world and not like something that sprung up from deep within it. When I see Greta Gerwig acting in a Noah Baumbach film after knowing that he left his wife and child to go be with Greta Gerwig, there is a part of me that's watching it from Jennifer Jason Leigh's point of view and just saying, isn't that nice that you have a cute girlfriend who you can make movies about youth with?
Jennifer Leigh as Laurie Metcalf and Greta Gerwig as Lady Bird.
I mean, that may be unfair, and it doesn't take away at all from my enjoyment of this movie, but I have to say that when there's those collaborations and there's that kind of Annie Hall adoring gaze on his girlfriend, I get a little bit creeped. But that said, I think all three of us, maybe not with the intensity of A.O. Scott and David Edelstein, but with effusion and enthusiasm, would send people to Lady Bird.
Yeah, it's a you know, when I think, I don't go to the movies as much as I used to, but when I think of the kind of, you know, it is a semi-subgenre of, you know, high school, smart, witty, fun, self-motivated high school girls and kind of figuring things out. This is one of the better of those movies that I can remember, and I just had a really good time in the cinema.
All right, Lady Bird, Greta Gerwig, do it up.
Bring it.
Before we move on to our next topic, we've got some business to do, June. What do we got?
Well, first we want to tell you about another great Slate show, The Gist, Slate's daily podcast hosted by Mike Pesca. It's about politics and culture and Mike's views of the world. And he recently had The New Yorker's Adam Davidson on to talk about the Republican tax plan and whether it even deserves to be called tax reform. He also had a fantastic interview with Michael Rapaport about sports and yelling. He also talked with someone about how to deal with racist Dr. Seuss books and the future of the Me Too movement. So check out The Gist at slate.com/thegist or wherever you get your podcasts. And in Slate Plus, we're inspired by an article on the future of cohabitation and multifamily homes to grill Seth Stevenson about growing up in such an arrangement. Are you ready for that, Seth?
Not at all ready.
We're going to go deep into your past.
We're going to
probe. Put me on the couch.
That's right. And to hear segments like that and to get ad-free podcasts, sign up for Slate Plus. Slate Plus is our membership program, and it's a great way to support the magazine. For just $35 for your first year, you can help cover the cost of producing the Culture Gabfest and your other favorite Slate shows. In return, you'll get extended ad-free versions of the show and other great Slate shows, and a ton of other fabulous benefits. So if you'd like to support the Culture Gabfest, go to slate.com/cultureplus. And join Slate Plus today. Okay, back to the show.
Thank you, June. So, Alias Grace is a new miniseries adaptation of the 1996 Margaret Atwood novel. It's a fictionalized take on the true story of an Irish immigrant and domestic servant who's accused of the murder of her masters in mid-19th century Canada. This Netflix series is produced and written by Sarah Polley. All six of its episodes, it's a limited series, are directed by Mary Herron. It stars Sarah Gadon as the supposed murderess, Edward Holcroft as her investigating doctor, and Anna Paquin as the housekeeper and murder victim. Let's listen to a clip from Alias Grace.
Well, according to my friend, there are three quilts every woman should make with her own hand before marriage. The Tree of Paradise, the Flower Basket, and the Pandora's Box. Sometimes in my days as a maid, I would hang them all up to dry off when we washed together in a row. They'd look like flags hung out by an army as it goes to war.
What else does that make you think of, Grace?
Well, since that time, I've thought, why is it that women have chosen to sew such flags and lay them on the tops of beds? For they make the bed the most noticeable thing in a room. And then I've thought, it's forewarning. Because you may think a bed is a peaceful thing, sir. To you, it may mean rest and comfort and a good night's sleep. But it isn't so for everyone. There are many dangerous things that may take place in a bed. It's where we are born. That's our first peril in life. It's where women give birth, which is often their last. And it's where the act takes place between men and women, sir, that I will not mention to you, but I suppose you know what it is. Some call it love, others despair. Merely an indignity they must suffer through.
All right. I guess I'll go around the table really quick again and ask what both of you thought of this before we dig in. Are you going to keep watching? How much have you seen?
I did watch the whole thing, and I enjoyed it. And I'm full of praise for so much. I thought Sarah Gadon was amazing as the lead, as the titular character. Pretty much everyone, except maybe Edward Holcroft, was really good. The writing was fantastic. The directing was great. But I found it a little bit dull. Partly it's that there's a lot of, as we heard in that clip, like there's people are talking to one another. And even though images, they don't just keep us inside the room where they're talking. You know, there's flashbacks and images and whatever it might be. But it was just kind of a bit like it didn't really quite grab me. There was always some part of my mind that was kind of looking away and just not totally focused on what was actually a very beautiful thing. And I'm a little puzzled by my reaction, but I have to admit to it.
Okay. What about you, Seth?
I agree with you, June. I watched the entire thing as well, partly because I'm a completist.
Yeah.
But I felt like the mystery, the semi-mystery at the heart of it, the true crime story.
Which is why she did what she did?
Yes. Or, why she did, it, or yeah. did she
or
do
what
she
happened.
Did or what exactly happened? Didn't really pan out for me or really hold my attention or really work on the screen. I felt like at times it kind of looked like a middling PBS costume drama, and but with material that was much rawer,
yes,
much more explicit.
Yeah.
I love Sarah Polley. I love that she took this on. I love that this is just like Canadian women everywhere yeah. you look.
Yeah. Is Sarah Gadon Canadian too?
She is. Sarah Polley's Canadian. Margaret Atwood is Canadian. Sarah Polley previously made a movie from a short story by Alice Munro, who's Canadian
yeah.
woman.
Yeah.
Canadian women for the win, no doubt. But my favorite part of this entire show was the voiceover that Sarah Gadon does, which I'm pretty sure is just Margaret Atwood's prose. And it was so much better for me than anything else in the show that it just made me feel like, gosh, I should have just read the book. I should read the book.
Yeah, yeah. I think Polly hewed pretty closely to even in the script to words from Margaret Atwood, and that so you get something like that really poetic voiceover that well not mm-hmm. voiceover, she's speaking to the psychiatrist, but that kind of lyrical run that we just heard, which is not necessarily the way anyone actually speaks, but
maybe in 1840 something.
Maybe if everybody was all the maids had such a good education, but
yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's so similar to what I feel, that there's so much about this that like I could write or I could go on and on. I could rapturize about the portrayal of just the horror of a working class woman in those days. And it is like a series of horrible things happen to Grace Marks. Her life is miserable. It's very, very clear how close women who worked as servants who didn't have pretty much all women, but especially servants, how close they were to being on the streets and just, you know, they had absolutely no protection from anything or anybody. It's very clear. It's one of the most direct representations of that vulnerability that I've seen. And yet it just there's something missing somehow.
Is it maybe? I've only gotten 2.5 episodes in, so I can't really judge as well. And I so far very much want to keep watching. But does maybe your hesitation, both of you, have something to do with the programmatic kind of nature of the feminism? Like, does it ever strike you that there are points being made or sort of an argument being put forth rather than a story being told?
It's actually the argument is the best part. You know, it's very subtle. There's this sense of the innate sort of brilliance of Grace. You know, she's like a Scheherazade character. She stayed alive by telling stories, and she's found a way of life in a sense that even though at one point she was condemned to die, she has stayed alive by telling stories. And much of the story is a way of communicating to people from a different background how hard life is for women, for servants especially. And so the programmatic, as you call it, aspects of it were actually the strength. I think it was just that what should be this like fascinating murder mystery is just not that fascinating. And I agree, Seth, that it's funny you called it PBS elements. To me, it's very much CBC elements. Like it wasn't a lot of it, but even though Mary Harron has nothing to do with CBC, there were just a few moments where I thought, oh my goodness, I've seen that in a historical, you know, like maybe in Murdoch Mysteries, you know. And in fact, there was one scene where Grace is traveling to the Kinnear household, which will, you know, be where the terrible events happen. And there's a guy who's in Murdoch Mysteries and he's this just terrible British actor. And I just thought, you shouldn't have cast that. You shouldn't have had that scene. Like, that just makes it seem like a bad CBC, like, historical drama.
You mean because there's sort of like a rotating cast of Law and Order style Canadian actors that appear?
Yeah,
things?
Exactly.
Well, Mary Harron, the director, another Canadian woman.
I did not know that.
Directed American Psycho. Yeah, and so that's that telling stories aspect you talked about, June.
Yeah.
That's something that Sarah Polley is clearly interested in. She did that documentary about a mystery within her own family called mm-hmm. Stories We Tell, where it's about how people tell these stories about what happened and they change and they shift for different audiences. And so that it was interesting to see Sarah Polley's fascination with that. In terms of like the programmatic feminism, it did, I would say, by episode 6, it was clear what this series's point of view was on men and men's relationships with women, certainly in the 1900s, probably, or in the 19th century, but probably now as well. There was not a single sympathetic man in the entire series, even the like seemingly nice guy farm boy, hashtag not all 19th century Canadian men. He was like, he is rebuffed and eventually does something nasty too. There's just no redeeming male characters. And I mean, the obvious thing to talk about in pop culturally here is The Handmaid's Tale, which right. is another series adapted from Margaret Atwood novel, appeared on Hulu instead of on Netflix. But again, that was another, it's two where you get women in like little caps
yeah.
who are, you know, being passed from man to man, and totally controlled by male society. And they're wanted only for domestic chores and for sex. And they have very little agency. And these shows are about them trying to find their agency within that.
Yeah. And Sarah Polley has said in interviews, I mean, she was no part of the Handmaid's Tale, but she sort of said that, you know, this is essentially for Atwood the same story that was projected forward into a dystopic future, but, you know, just looking back to a real case that resembles it in the past.
Speaking of acting, which, as I said, Sarah Gadon, who I'd never seen before, fully amazing. But I was really pleased to see Paul Gross, and he actually wasn't that good. So he's the guy who was in Slings and Arrows. He was in True North, and he looks amazing. Like, he's so perfect for the part. He's still very attractive. In fact, he's a guy, one of those men who seems to be getting more attractive as he gets older. He has this physical strength that he's kind of holding back, you know, that you can tell just this guy has a lot of power. Sometimes, you know, he's known as a liberal master, you know, he's still got all the power. And he is really good, except that he really just cannot do a Scottish accent, which was surprising to me. But it was so nice to see him because it's been a while, and he's the kind of actor that just somehow he pleases me to see him.
Two other quick things that I'll say about this. One is that I loved how there's this society of earnest Canadians who want to get her, you know, let off. And it kind of reminded me of like the Free Adnan movement, where
yes.
where Dr. Simon, the psychologist, is their Sarah Koenig, and they've got this alleged criminal who they are certain could not have done this crime, but it slowly becomes unclear how sympathetic this person actually is. And the other thing is that there is this, not to spoil it for you, Dana, I'll be careful, but there's this late episode turn that's somewhat hackneyed B-movie device that sort of explains how the crime could have happened, or how the killer could be telling one story but doing something else. And it's kind of lowest common denominator plot device in my view. It set the whole thing wrong in my mind when that happened.
I agree completely. It's something that's really hard to talk about, and so we won't, listeners. But I'm so with you, Seth. I thought that was a big mistake. It kind of there's a really fantastic representation of ambiguity. Like, there's the most superficial way of saying it is like, is she lying? And we learn that that is not the question. It's about how we all tell stories, how we all, you know, represent things differently to different audiences, and that's essential. And also how we understand ourselves, how we, you know, and how a very sensitive storyteller just really picks up on what the person he or she is talking to, so that they can please them in a way and just give them what they want. But
all that sounds good. Those all sound like good qualities in a twist.
Yeah, they do. They do. And that's a thing with this show. Like
everything's there, but you're just not feeling
it.
It's a twist you've seen before in a lot of not very good TV shows and movies.
Yeah.
Well, now I have to keep watching just to see whether the twist is good or bad, because you say it's terrible and then you describe it and it sounds like Stories We Tell, which was an incredible movie, and I think is probably more recommendation worthy than this show. But I think if you start this show, you will not regret it.
Yeah. No, and actually, and just to be clear, that I think that ambiguity and that really sort of very profound understanding of storytelling and how we, you know, decide what we say to other people is undermined or undercut by this device.
Agree.
All right. Well, we'll wrap it there. Alias Grace is on Netflix, and you can come on and tell us what you think, or whether you're going to finish it, or whether you approve or disapprove of the mysterious twist at our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Rolling Stone, the storied rock and roll magazine, turns 50 years old this year. It was founded in the summer of love, right? 1967? Wasn't that the summer of love?
Yeah. Although the first episode came out November 9th, 1967.
Okay. So they were closing it during the very end of the summer of love.
Exactly.
It's a magazine that holds a hallowed place in the minds of baby boomers and culture writers alike. There's a new biography by Joe Hagan of the magazine's founder, Jan Wenner, and there is also a new two-part, four-hour documentary from HBO that digs into the early days of the magazine. Let's start off by listening to a clip from that show.
We had an ad for the groupie issue that said, when we tell you about a groupie, will you really understand? And we were saying, hey, we got the goods. You want to know what's really happening? Listen to us.
This was just complete shock to everybody, you know. The fact that rock and roll and the culture of rock and roll had this world underneath it. It was the generation gap starting to be writ large.
Jan had a particular view of what he wanted Rolling Stone to be. He was always thinking way down the road, ahead of himself, and maybe ahead of the generation to a certain extent.
All right, I think that kind of insubstantial clip actually really captures the mood of the documentary. We don't have to dwell super long on this documentary, which I think we would all agree is authorized to within an inch of its life so that you don't really get a full portrait of the magazine. But let's start with your histories at Rolling Stone. The reason we're doing this topic is because both of you said, I have something to say about the 50th anniversary of Rolling Stone.
You're overselling it now.
I'm just saying, I myself have no real relation to this magazine, certainly not as a writer, not really even as a reader. And maybe I just missed it generationally. I'm not sure. But both of you have feelings about it. So I'm just going to go around quickly and ask about your own histories with Rolling Stone. Okay, June.
So in the late 70s, when I was in college, I would get copies of Rolling Stone and actually the New Yorker too from this magazine store in Manchester that had American magazines. And I wasn't so much reading it for the music coverage, which there was better music coverage in Britain and like the NME and Sounds and Melody Maker, but the representation of American, I guess, youth culture. It was the place where that was easy to read about. I mean, so in Britain, you could learn about America from like Newsweek and Time were available. And of course, like there was coverage on TV, but that wasn't of, you know, that was something different. And I think my impression and in a way my desire in part, not certainly wasn't a huge part of it, to come to America and live in that culture was sort of sparked by the view of not exactly politics. I don't even know really what part of American culture it was. I guess because it wasn't all that underground by that point. It was America somehow and young America. And later, kind of when I got to a part of my life where I was feeling like, oh, music's just, I've lost track of music. I don't even know the names of bands. And I actually took a subscription for a while just to kind of try and get a sense back of music. And it completely failed at that because by that time it was when like Christina Aguilera was on the cover all the time. And it was just like, that's not even music that I would have any interest in. And it kind of become very much like either going back to the past or clearly trying to represent what was popular music and just it wasn't very convincing.
Scantily clad pop
absolutely
starlets.
Absolutely.
Baby boomer sensibility. So I have a two-part history with Rolling Stone, a double issue, if you will. And the first part is as a reader, when I was like 12 years old in the mid-1980s, I subscribed to Rolling Stone because I thought it was really cool. It was Rolling Stone. And I think that was sort of the tail end of its real relevance. Maybe its real cultural relevance was already over by then. You know, for a while, it had been like the white hot beating heart of the counterculture. It was like the counterculture monoculture. You had to go to Rolling Stone to get the counterculture. And I remember even when I was reading in the mid-80s, the ads in the back of the magazine, the personal ads, felt like this bulletin board for cool, weird people because it was the only place you could reach those other cool, weird people. But I have a sense that, you know, a 12-year-old living in suburban Massachusetts didn't actually have his thumb. I probably wasn't that cool. And I think that cultural relevance just went quickly downhill from that period. And, you know, and now, like, what Rolling Stone, what does that mean even? The internet just killed it when suddenly these people who had these strange obsessions and these countercultural ideas could meet up on the internet and these forums. And now it's like, what's the Rolling Stone of now? It's like Reddit, or it's like it's Instagram, where the celebrities go and they completely control their images, and they just talk to their fans directly instead of needing to talk to the Rolling Stone report. That was the interesting thing I saw in that documentary, at least in part one of that documentary, Dana, was the access that the writers and photographers had to these rock stars in the late 60s and the early 70s, where you just show up at Tina Turner's house and she hasn't got home yet. You just kind of walk around, or Annie Leibovitz going in, and nobody dresses up. Nobody has on costumes. Nobody has a stylist. They're just sitting on their couch rolling a joint, and Annie Leibovitz just taking photos of them. Yeah. That does not happen now. And you can trace the way Rolling Stone's coverage of celebrities and rock stars changed over time. I wish I had been a part of that journalistic era. Yeah. But speaking of being a part of a journalistic, Rolling Stone journalistic sensibility. So later, part two of my Rolling Stone relationship. I'm just going to keep talking.
Fast forward through the adolescence, the early adulthood, and into the mature years of Seth Stevenson.
Thank you for allowing me to take a breath. So part two was in the late 90s, early 2000s, when I was like 25, 26 years old. I got to freelance for them. And this was very exciting to me. I mean, this is Bunter S. Thompson had written for this place. And I remember when I was 12 reading like serialized chapters from Tom Wolfe books, and like this, I was like, whoa, Rolling Stone, and I'm freelancing for them. And then the freelance assignments turned out to be, I think the first one was, I want to preface this by saying my editors were lovely people, wonderful people, caught up in this Rolling Stone machinery, which maybe we should blame Jan Wenner on. I don't blame my editors. But like one of the first assignments I had was they were like, we want you, it was a spring break issue, and they wanted me to do captions of spring breakers on spring break in Cancun or something. And I was supposed to write captions of like people in bathing suits, like hot girls in bathing suits. And I was like, I mean, I'm 25, it's Rolling Stone, I'm going to take the assignment, but I was wasn't sure what the mission here was, what the aim of this was. And then also I realized that in fact they had to use pictures from the previous year's spring break in order to have time to do the layout. So it wasn't even like actual documenting spring break in that year. It was documenting like a year old spring break just to have photos of hot people in bathing suits. And I was like, what am I doing? And then the next assignment I got,
I want to read the captions you wrote.
I don't remember how I solved that dilemma. The next assignment I got was, there was this, it was for the college issue. And in the college issue of Rolling Stone, there was this kid at Northwestern who, remember, this is before like online porn. And what he did was catalog porn DVDs. You wanted a certain porn starlet using like whips and chains, outdoors, like if you, whatever fetish you had, you could cross-reference them and he would tell you which porn DVD you should buy. And then there would be a link to buy the DVD. It's a very disjointed way of acquiring your porn that we don't recognize anymore. Anyway, this kid was an entrepreneur. And what he did was he had his Northwestern undergrad classmates watching porn DVD after porn DVD after porn DVD to catalog the fetishes and the props and the actresses and so forth, and paying them some pittance to do it. And anyway, I was profiling this kid and I followed him out to the San Fernando Valley where he was trying to make connections in the porn world. We went on all these porn sets, which was disturbing and not at all erotic. And I still sometimes have flashbacks to that, and they're very disturbing. So anyway, I write up the whole thing. I'm like, wow, I wrote this story about the world of porn, and I've got, you know, color from the porn sets where they're like urinating in the swimming pools and like strange things are happening. And I write, and then my editor comes back to me and says, Jan killed it because it was for the college issue, but you spent too much time in San Fernando Valley, so it didn't feel campusy, so he killed it. This is like, you know, weeks of my life traveling to Southern California for days and days. A photographer was out there with me taking all these shots. It was like all this effort. And like on a whim, Jan Wenner had just said, nope, not going to do it. Which I guess, you know, that is the right of an imperialistic.
Droit de seigneur.
Yeah, exactly. But that was my feeling. And then also, you know, increasingly, I had a lot of trouble getting paid by them. Oh. I just wouldn't get paid on time.
Did they give you a decent kill fee for that?
No,
story?
And it would always be like they would assign the story at like several thousand dollars, and then you would get like $300 for your time, for your weeks of time. And finally, I gave up and I said, enough of this. I cannot deal with this magazine anymore. It just felt very chaotic over there and at the whims of this guy. And I just refuse to keep writing for them.
Good
that
for
is
you.
Part two.
Wow.
Of our Rolling Stone story.
Okay, I'm glad you told both parts. Now my esteem for the magazine is plummeting even more. I mean, I have to say that watching the first 2 hours of this 4-hour HBO documentary, and also reading a lot about the new Joe Hagan biography of Jan Wenner, I was amazed that the magazine could operate at the level of chaos that you describe. I mean, you describe it from the inside in a way that I hadn't yet seen in this coverage, but
it seems like also at the top levels, there was tons of drugs being done, which is not at all focused on in the documentary. I mean, it's so dishonest.
Yeah,
there's one
mentioned.
Little winking reference to, oh, we would puff on a joint before we wrote our stories. But apparently, according to Hagen's biography, which I think is pretty well-sourced and accurate, Jan Wenner would hand out packets of cocaine as a bonus to writers. I mean, how does a magazine function like that? Can you imagine Julia Turner? Nice job, June. Here's your blow.
That was interesting. There was a New Yorker review of the biography, and it talked a little bit about it. It was written by a journalist who had sort of come of journalistic age in the early aughts, saying, well, how did they do that?
Right.
Like, by the time I got there, there's so little money left in journalism that you just had to be incredibly responsible and turn in clean copy and be polite and incredibly professional because you were freaked out that you weren't getting another assignment. You weren't going to get a job.
And, you weren't going to get paid.
Yeah. I came in just at the very tail end of when there was actual money in journalism. And I remember I was at I worked at Newsweek in the late 90s, and they would tell these stories about people doing cocaine off the light boxes. No, like kids now, like the Slate interns now don't even know what a light box is. It's,
right.
It's when you put the photo negative on a box that projects light through. Anyway, so, but that was done by, 2003, probably.
Right.
We missed it, guys. We missed it. We missed the party.
Well, I mean, if you want to vicariously relive that party, the documentary really does celebrate it in a pretty glamorized way. I mean, you do see a little bit of Hunter S. Thompson, for example, going on assignment with cases of vodka that they would ship with him and, hookers or whatever. I mean, another thing that's huge is in this documentary and in all the coverage I've seen of the biography is just the sexism embedded in that universe. I mean, even in the clip we heard, it was the groupie issue, that was one of their big sensational early issues. And it just really seems like, in a way that is not acknowledged by the documentary, that the whole magazine was built on this very lad mag sensibility.
Yeah, there's in part two, there are a few places where, like, a woman editor will say, I'm sure sincerely, people were laughing at when I tried to, bring up some like rape culture story or And everyone, people were laughing, but Jan, he took it very seriously. He was, they'll trot out one of the very few women writers and editors, or there are a couple actually who were mentioned.
And Annie Leibovitz.
And Annie Leibovitz, gets a ton of coverage, which, fair enough, deserves it. And so, but nobody really says, gosh, are we noticing that all these superstars, many of them are difficult men? There's a lot about Hunter Thompson's coverage of the, the Pulitzer trial, and it's, he falls in love with the way, and it's just sort of, it's unacknowledged and yet very, very obvious, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, teens attitudes that were, let's just say, pre-woke.
Mm. Yeah, well, and then the most recent example of that, which I don't know if this comes up later in the documentary, was I think it was in 2014, the scandal around the coverage of a rape case in Rolling Stone magazine, which was this sort of shockingly unsourced story that had to be retracted later.
Yeah, they do talk about it. I mean, they take a lot of credit for publishing the investigation by Steve Cole and people at the Columbia School of Journalism. And they take a lot of time to cover the Michael Hastings piece about General McChrystal, which was like because other than the UVA case, I was trying to think, like, when was the last time I even noticed a story in Rolling Stone? And I guess it was that General McChrystal story. And so they definitely give that a lot of coverage, too.
And we should probably just mention about the biography. So Jan Wenner agreed. It was this somewhat authorized biography with this writer, Joe Hagen, where Jan Wenner said, I want you to. And he did hours and hours and hours of interviews and access to all of his friends and his celebrity friends and his ex-wife and blah, blah, blah. And then Joe Hagen delivered this biography that was not what Jan Wenner had been expecting. And I haven't read it yet, but the excerpts I've read and the reviews make it sound very dishy. And I kind of am excited to read it. But Jan Wenner was not pleased.
Yeah.
There's a big feud, I guess, going on between the two of them where he's getting out in the press and trying to counteract. I mean, it almost even seems like this documentary, this is pure speculation, but like it might have been thrown together as a counterpunch.
This is what he hoped the book was going to
be.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I don't know about thrown together because there obviously is a lot of work. I mean, it's a frustrating document because it is interesting. I found it interesting. It's good to see those times. And as you say, just that view of like, oh, my God, the access that people used to have, like those halcyon days of journalism. But there's a lot of work put into it. But it's incredibly hagiographic. It's incredibly there's so much is just not even mentioned that we know, just even without the kind of reading about Hagen's biography. Just by being present in this culture, you know things about Jan Wenner, you know things about Rolling Stone, and they're never even whispered in the documentaries.
Well, let's be, I haven't done the Steve Metcalf thing yet, and sort of pull historically back and try to get some sense of what this magazine does mean to the culture. I mean, we can pick apart that bad documentary. I really think it's a facile, terrible piece of work, and talk about the biography that none of us have read. But what about what the magazine itself has meant and stood for? And do you think that that's something worth celebrating and remembering after 50 years?
Yeah. I mean, so Jack Hamilton did a really interesting review of the Joe Hagan book in Slate, and he sort of talked about, you know, as he was going through, he said, you know, you should read this issue from start to finish. Every word is fascinating. I mean, there are, and even in the documentary, which I did find historically interesting, even while recognizing that it's, you know, phoned in to a certain extent, when they do that hack thing where they, you know, the voice of God, which in this case I think is Jeff Daniels, you know, reads the prose out loud, and there's a lot of really good prose. You know, it's sexist. It's all from a certain male point of view. I mean, I know all the issues with it, but it's really, you know, it was great reading. It was revolutionary in its time. There were many revolutions that it ignored. But for what it did cover, it's a fantastic picture of that time.
Yeah, I think for 5 or 10 years, it was a truly great magazine with like these amazing revealing interviews with stuff, like the John Lennon stuff. You know, he just poured it all out there when he talked to these interviewers, and it really shaped how people felt about him. And that was amazing stuff. And there was great journalism, the Hunter S. Thompson stuff, however you feel about it. I mean, a very entertaining writer. You know, it's serializing Tom Wolfe book chapters. Like as a kid, when I subscribed to Rolling Stone, that's how I got exposed to that. That's how I started reading Tom Wolfe books, because I think, you know, by the time the internet came, it was pretty much done as a truly relevant, you know, path breaking kind of thing. But I think at the start it was a great book.
Yeah.
We call magazines books sometimes to be cool, just to be clear to readers.
And they have fronts and backs if you want to be even cooler.
Like, what's the hot book right now? I mean, we used to say that about Talk in the late 90s.
Yeah. Can I just say like that story from Cameron Crowe about like Jan calls him in and like they fly him from wherever, San Diego to San Francisco. And he, just for that, like to have an afternoon with Jan, and Jan gives him his own personal copy of Slouching Toward Bethlehem.
Well, that's, I meant to mention, because that's, think about that. Yeah. Where he's like, Cameron Crowe, you wrote an okay story, but it could be better. Come meet with me. Let me give you a copy of a Joan Didion book and encourage you. Yeah. And then, I write my porn DVD cataloging story. And it's just, I hear from like 4 levels down, oh, Jan killed it. Why wasn't I brought in?
Where's your Almost Famous?
Why wasn't I given a copy of a book that was close to Jan Wenner's heart and maybe a pack of cocaine and told to get back out there and do better? Why? Now I'm angry.
Born too late, Seth Stevenson. Born too late.
All right. Well, if you have thoughts about the front or back of the book Rolling Stone, please share them with us at facebook.com/culturefest. Wow, we've done it. This moved faster than the editing in Lady Bird. We've gotten to the part of the show where we endorse already. I'm going to miss you guys. All right, June, what have you got?
Okay, I'm really embarrassed or sort of hesitant to make my recommendations, even though of late I've not been watching as much television because I'm absolutely obsessed with YouTube craft videos. And like some of the ones that I watch, like I really recommend this guy, James Luke Burke, or maybe he just goes by James Burke. And he like does... like he just crafts while he's talking, and he's very charming. He's an Aussie. He's got a great accent. And then sometimes he'll do like tutorials. I learned how to do a few Halloween type drawings from his videos. But then sometimes I watch like really like precise card making of a type that I neither would ever make or would ever send or would ever receive. But there's something so calming about watching someone make like greeting cards, and I don't know if I've just reached a certain age and like some part of my brain has exploded or something, but I swear. So here's some people.
So this is your ASMR.
Yeah,
of.
It really is. And so here are some of the YouTubers who I recommend if you like this kind of thing. So Jennifer McGuire and Kay Werner Design. They are ultimate craft, ultimate greeting card makers, just amazing stuff. And then I really love this. It's a shop. It's an online store, but they also do videos that I think are really fantastic. It's called joggles.com. That is the name of the store, but also of the YouTube account. And so, like, I don't know. I'm totally obsessed with craft videos on YouTube these days.
Who
oh, my
isn't?
God. That is so June. I love it, especially because I very much doubt you're doing most of the craft projects, right? You're
no.
just letting them wash over
exactly.
you.
Exactly. And it's, but I like, and it's the funny thing is it makes me want to buy a few things, you know, like it just triggered the like retail therapy kind of aspect of it. I just own that like thing that helps you take, I mean.
It fits into your office supply.
Yes, exactly. It's definitely related, but it's also like, it's just not the kind of thing I would necessarily do or be capable of doing, quite honestly, but it's just so soothing.
Careful, you're going to have a Jan Wenner $350 a week crafting habit that you can't shake.
Yeah, that's not even a joke. Yeah.
All right, crafting videos. I didn't see that coming, but I love it. Seth, what about you?
I will make two half endorsements. The first is, since we were talking about charming high school movie, I'm going to recommend another charming high school movie that maybe not ton of people have seen, called Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist, which with Michael Cera and Kat Dennings. Kat Dennings. I'm like Liam Neeson's. anyway, it's really sweet and also similarly very generous to its characters. Every character has redeeming qualities. It bounces along. It's got a great soundtrack. It's not a film of tremendous depth, but I just, whenever it's on, I find I watch it. And so I'm going to recommend it. And then the other thing I'm going to recommend is another semi-guilty pleasure, which is in Lady Bird, which is the Dave Matthews Band song Crash Into Me, which plays a role in the plot, where at a certain point it comes on the radio and the bad boyfriend says, "What a lame song, this song's so lame." And that is the moment or a moment where Lady Bird says, "No." At first she's like, "Oh yeah," but then she's like, "No, I like this song." And she stands up for herself and she is not afraid to say she likes Dave Matthews Band. And it's a pivotal moment for the character. And I will say, I also, despite many very lame connotations with the Dave Matthews Band, and I'm not going to recommend the band as a whole or its work as a whole, it's canon, but I will say I like that song. I like Crash Into Me.
That's actually one of the qualities of the character Lady Bird that we didn't mention in our segment that I love, which is that she's completely self-confident to a fault.
Yes.
Like, she's
yes.
almost obnoxious in the degree to which she believes in her own taste and her own dreams and her own visions.
She runs for student office every year.
Knowing she won't win, yes. not wanting to win.
She doesn't care about cool, which is so rare, like, for actual high schoolers and for actual, you know, and for actual high schoolers and for representations of high schoolers in the movies. And it's lovely. It's a lovely part of Lady Bird.
I have one more little note on Seth's endorsement, which is that Nick and Nora's Infinite Playlist mainly sticks with me because of one of the side characters played by Ari Grainer, the best friend.
Yes, she's terrific in
it. So good. And I've been looking for that actress. You see her once in a while in things since then. She's kind of an Angie Dickinson lookalike, and she has just this great brash manner, and I really hope she gets more roles.
I also find her great in everything she does, yeah.
She was on a Showtime show, which I'm pretty sure only had one season, which actually is set in the world of roadies. It was directed by Cameron Crowe. Created by him, and it just wasn't very good, but she was kind of good in it.
Yeah, she needs to get more work. Ari Grainer. Okay, my endorsement this week is highbrow. Now I'm embarrassed that I went highbrow when you guys had such fun, jolly pop culture recommendations, but this is actually, in a way, popular culture, because I think this is something that brings a difficult text to a lot of new readers. There's a new translation of the Odyssey, Homer's Odyssey. It's the first translation by a woman in the history of the book. Her name's Emily Wilson, and she's a professor at Penn. I hope we get to have her on the show and talk about translating Homer, because that just seems like an incredible task that she undertook. But to give you an idea of the freshness of this translation, I'm just going to read the very famous opening to the Odyssey, which, if you've read in translation, I think you know, usually starts with the first line is something like, "O Muse, tell me about the man of many ways," or something like that. And it's this sort of difficult word to translate, the word that is translated often as the man of many ways, polytropos, which means a person of many tropes, right? A person of many turns. So here's the beginning of Emily Wilson's translation of the Odyssey. "Tell me about a complicated man. Muse, tell me how he wandered and was lost when he had wrecked the holy town of Troy, and where he went and who he met, the pain he suffered in storms at sea, and how he worked to save his life and bring his men back home. He failed to keep them safe. Poor fools, they ate the sun god's cattle, and the god kept them from home. Now, goddess, child of Zeus, tell the old story for our modern times. Find the beginning. I just think that's such a grabby beginning to such a familiar poem. And something about kicking off with this, tell me about a complicated man, really does bring it into modern times. Anyway, I'm only a book and a half or so into this massive tome, but it's really fresh and wonderful reading so far. And I didn't think that I needed to reread Homer's Odyssey right now, but it turns out we all do.
I mean, the Odyssey is a pretty good cultural artifact. But again, I'm going to say Crash Into Me by Dave Matthews Band. Think about it.
I'm just going to say, make some greeting cards with YouTube. Okay?
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about, be they letterpress kits or copies of Homer's Odyssey, on our show page at slate.com/culturefest. You can email us at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note at Facebook at facebook.com/culturefest. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch. Our intern is Daniel Schrader. The executive producer of Slate Podcasts is Steve Lichtai. The Culture Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network, and you can find a whole roster of wonderful shows at panoply.fm. Our Twitter feed is @SlateCultFest. For June Thomas and Seth Stevenson, I'm Dana Stevens, and we'll see you next week.